Hey there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. You are joining us for an apologetics episode today. As I've talked about the last several weeks, we are rotating through the various categories that we've built up over the last 2 years. For people who are new to the show, the first 2 years of podcasting, we picked a category, essentially, either theological doctrine, apologetics, church history, and then some special topic episodes. And we usually stuck with those for a good period of time, somewhere between 20 and 30 episodes at a time. And what that did is it kind of established a really good baseline of episodes that we could refer people back to on a lot of topics. I mean, we managed to cover a lot of material in those first 2 years, especially as far as doctrine goes and apologetics. And in the church history series, we did Great Thinkers of the Christian Faith, and we got through quite a few important figures to Christianity that are, you know, foundational to Western Christianity and Western thought. And so what we're doing now is, now that we've hit our third year of podcasting and we have these sections built up, is we are attempting to record one or two episodes in each category every month. So we did a church history episode. We did a great thinker again. We did C.S. Lewis at the beginning of this month. We did a special topic with the questions and answers episode. We did a theological doctrine episode with the two natures in Christ. And now that we are going to start the month of February, well, this is the last episode in January, so this will be an apologetics episode to round off January, and then in February, we're going to start off again with similar topics. We'll do doctrine, history, apologetics. So today, we're going to do an apologetics episode, and we're going to talk about epistemology, or how you know what you know. And if anybody listened to the interview I did with Dr. Montgomery, this was what he pointed out is basically the ground level. The first thing you need to do when you start approaching apologetics is ask epistemological questions, so that you have a baseline for the rest of the groundwork that you need to do to build up kind of your answers to possible questions that might come your way.
Any good introduction to philosophy is going to have a chapter on this subject.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of foundational. Like Concordia, you get both Adam and Scott teach in the core, right? And epistemology is the first step in core, is it not?
It wasn't my class. I mean, I taught core theology. I don't teach it much anymore, but I taught core theology for years. And I would always start that class with what is it exactly you believe? Why do you believe it? What or who are your sources of authority? Why do you trust them? And then parlayed that into a conversation on why we trust anything, how we know anything to be true or false. And then parlayed that into a discussion on the New Testament documents and their historicity and their trustworthiness, and then on to Christ, and then dun-dun-dun down the line.
And I think one of the reasons it's foundational is because a lot of people have never asked the question, how do I know anything at all, before. And so when somebody finally asks them that, they kind of get the blabbling answer, you know, kind of pondering at the obscure. And what we're going to try to do today is get kind of the heart of the matter. Apologetically, I think it's important because when you do approach people, they don't necessarily know why they have the questions that they do, or even some of the answers they think they have to Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the differences in epistemology are what caused some of the tension between people who would call themselves scientific and Christians, right? And so that's my hope today, is that we get to that, to kind of start at the basics of apologetics again, because it's been a while since we did that series. So, Dr. Keith, you do this introduction called the Epistemology of Theology. So if we're going to engage in theological material, engage with theological material and theological thought, how do we use epistemology to start?
When I teach this, I go off of the starting point that James Sire uses in his book, Why Should Anyone Believe Anything at All?
Good choice.
Because he talks about sources, essentially sources of authority. And he argues for the reality that we all believe things, number one, which I think is with the current well, probably every generation of young person, young adult, that's a good place to start to actually discuss the idea that we all believe things that are objective, you know, that are their truth or falsity is not dependent on our feelings about it. Like, we just they are true, and we believe them to be true. And he talks about why we believe things. And he gives different reasons for that, having, you know, sociological reasons or psychological reasons. There's all sorts of things, or religious reasons. But for me, it's a good starting point because I'm able, by means of a conversation, which is sometimes hard with students, especially freshman students, by means of a conversation to flesh out not only what do they believe, but the ground level for why they believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And then to make comparisons to that and religious claims. And then you can sort of make the comparisons between most religious claims and the claims of Christianity based on the New Testament Gospels, which are historically, you know, based and discuss things that happened in real time, real space, and real history, and that were attested to and witnessed by multiple observers, and that those testimonies are listed in the Gospels. And so it's that type of sort of epistemological discussion on how we know anything at all. I'll even go into what type of statements, you know, do we make from Dr. Montgomery and the analytic tradition, you know, analytic, synthetic, nonsensical. But it's helpful because it frames the conversation. For me, as I'm teaching theology, it frames the conversation so that eventually we get into straight doctrine in that class. In other words, this is the doctrine of sin, this is doctrine of justification.
Sure.
But I can always refer back to those preliminary conversations we had saying, this is why I know this is true when I talk about the doctrine of sin. And I'm not just saying it, you know, the Bible says it, I believe it, that's enough for me. I can tell you why I believe the Bible is trustworthy too.
Yes, and most religions cannot.
Yeah.
The table gets in many ways swept pretty clean by any kind of analysis like this. The classical fight over it in the 19th century was John Henry Cardinal Newman, The Idea of a University.
Yeah, they read parts of that in that class.
Do they?
Yeah.
Yep.
He lost that fight, but he shouldn't have.
Yeah.
It wasn't because he didn't have a good case. What he was arguing was that every university should have a department of theology. Answer from his critics at that time, theology has no epistemology. There's no objective knowledge to be dealt with.
Just blind faith.
And I wish he would have won that argument, but he didn't. But that's where the attack really came at the university level. John Henry Cardinal Newman, The Idea of a University.
Yeah, and some of this gets into conversations. I may have mentioned it a couple shows ago, but had been engaging with a group of atheists online, and we disagreed on the definition of faith. Is what it came down to. I believed that faith could have an epistemology, right?
Uh-huh.
And he defined faith as
believing what you know ain't true.
blind belief in a deity. Okay. I said, well, that's not a good working definition of faith.
Nope.
So, you know, until we can come to an agreement on that's not what I'm talking about here,
uh-huh.
There's not going to be any progress. And so that's from the outside, I think that's still definitely true. So that was true during the university period there for Newman, but today, the only intellectual conversations I've had with atheists get hung up on that very same.
Yep.
Same thing. Adam, so you're a historian, right? So this is pretty core to what you do, right? Especially with students. I bet most of the papers that have problems, it comes from statements like I believe statements instead of dealing with the actual sources of where we get our information, right?
Yeah, this is the big perennial question any sort of historiography, you know, the writing of history is, on what basis can you even make claims about history? You know, literary sources, archaeological evidence, or is it all a construct, and so on
yep.
and so forth. And in the realm of Christian apologetics, Christianity is contingent upon certain historical facts.
Yep, dependent.
And so epistemology and history are like central to the apologetic task. And so the way I treat it in history, especially the apologetic side of things, is how do we know what we know about what happened in the past?
Mm-hmm.
On what, you know, what sort of evidence do we look for? How much evidence do you need? All of it comes to bear.
What's a reasonable amount to convince you?
Have you ever read, or do you have any recommendation about the book, The Killing of History?
Yeah, by Windschuttle. He's an Australian. So it's a great book. And there have been several in the last 10, 15 years with titles like In Defense of History or The Killing of History, which are defenses of the historical discipline, just writing history over and against postmodern history, which says, so like the postmodernists, they're all over the board, but when in the realm of history, their claim is that the past is really unknowable. The way we describe the past is just a construct.
It's just a social construct, man.
Yeah. Nietzsche said, it's a mobile army of metaphors or something like that. You know, everything we say about the past is just this metaphors about what we think about the past. But you can't, when you write a sentence about what happened in the past, the postmodernist says, you certainly can't be certain, but you can't even be reasonably convinced that your sentence actually corresponds to something that happened in the past. So Richard Rorty would be the big name in American postmodern circles. He argued once, or responded to his critics, who said, you use education, history, everything, basically for propagandic purposes. His response? True.
Uh-huh. Dr. Horton had dinner with Rorty and gave a factual defense of the truth of the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And Rorty's response to it was, do people still do that?
Wow.
Yeah, that's sad.
But see, that's I'm going to use clean language. That's a ridiculous response at the same time, because you're not even giving sufficient weight to an argument that's being presented to you. You're just attacking the idea of making the argument.
Yeah.
But I'm not defending Rorty here, but if you look at recent apologetic literature, you'll find titles like "There is no such thing as objective truth, and it's a good thing too."
Yep.
Or "Who's afraid of postmodernism?" Where the book's not all bad, but the introduction basically says Christians are absolved of the apologetic task. Christians are not to be in the business of demonstrating the truthfulness of Christianity, or something like that. And so I imagine Rorty, his interaction with Christians, are these Christians who have basically cowering in the corner, so scared or timid of postmodernity and relativism, so they start playing the games of postmodernity,
mm-hmm.
and they don't hear the classic.
Well, it's kind of our own fault through religious language of the neo-Orthodox and that type of thing. You're not, you know, these aren't events that happened in real history; they happened in history.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
just like Rudolph did. You know, this same kind of thing that we don't. The religious language and actual language are not the same thing. You know, the language that I use to describe this table and stool that we're sitting at and on would not be the same as my description of Christ's resurrection from the death. That one is essentially mythical language, I think, probably the way to say it.
Sure.
And one is language where we describe the reality of the universe that we inhabit.
Yeah. Rorty's own self-description would be, I am a pragmatist.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's
pragmatist. And as soon as you're in that realm, does it work?
Yeah.
You've lost all contact with, is it true?
Yeah. You're in the realm of Kevin Spacey in the show House of Cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the refrain is ruthless pragmatism.
Right. Uh-huh.
Whatever works.
Yep.
Whatever to
I just hate power. The chronological snobbery that comes along with statements like that.
Sure.
Yeah. But so if you look at, let's say, 19th century to the present, what you see in the realm of Christian interaction with culture is an increasing acceptance of their marginalization in the fringes of culture. And increasing, like you mentioned Rudolph, I guess you're in first name terms with Boltman, but Rudolph Boltman and their sorry, their acceptance of all this, the intellectual trends of the day, and then they start describing Christianity, its epistemology, and those trends. And so Christians accept in the 19th, 20th century sort of existentialist Christianity faith claims are just simply private claims. They're not to be discussed.
There's psychiatric ones that help you to cope day by day.
Well, and there's historical reasons why the continent, the European continent went this direction. I mean, we don't have time for it today, but there's some real fear going on that I think in Europe that if we continue to hold to objective religious claims or even objective truth claims that are dealing with higher issues of right and wrong or honor and dishonor, that we can be brought into another war that kills a third of our population. I mean, in some ways, some of these attempts by many of the neo-Orthodox, you know, first it goes to the liberals who they just kind of get rid of everything, right?
Yep.
All miracles are out altogether. Yep. The neo-Orthodox come along and they're actually, I mean, they're trying. They want to bring some of this language back in, but they're afraid. I think they're afraid too. I mean, many of told us this in the class is that these people, they lived it.
Yep. Correct me if I'm wrong.
They're out of concentration camps or something in some cases, right?
Sure. Carl Barton's distinction between history or Geschichte and history, that the resurrection is in the realm of
it's history,
meta-history or whatever however you want to define it.
Really happened, but you couldn't film it.
Right, and wasn't that, I mean, to give him, I don't know if we're giving him credit, but isn't that his attempt to wall Christianity off from scrutiny?
Think of the title of his gigantic magnum opus, Church Dogmatics.
20-some-odd volumes.
Yeah. Church Dogmatics. In other words, to the doubter, the door is closed.
Yeah.
I don't want to be involved in any version of Christianity that says the epistemological door is closed.
Well, that's interesting. Instead of Christian dogmatics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or systematic theology.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
He didn't choose those titles.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And Barth himself was seen as a fundamentalist.
Absolutely. See, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought where you were going with this, Adam, which I think is just, it's interesting and terrifying at the same time, is how far culturally we've gone down the road to the acceptance of not believing anything as verifiable.
Yeah. Yep. I'm just, so lately I've been thinking, maybe I'm wrong, probably I'm wrong, my wife will tell me, that we like to critique secular culture, but we don't look at ourselves and sort of like the missteps we've taken, or and so
what we've done to lead to.
How many times do we say, "I used to believe, but I discovered it was foolishness"? I used to believe X.
Yeah, I read a book, and maybe I don't know if this is worthy of the show notes. It's by Frederick Gregory. He's a historian of science, and the title is Nature Lost, Natural Science in the German Theological Traditions of the 19th Century. And he covers...
Sounds like a page-turner.
Woo! It's actually, I mean, it's good. And the teaching company, he does the... Yeah. He's the guy who does the history of science, and it's really good. Or okay. I think the Darwinian Revolution, I think it's called. Really good. But in this book, he looks at various German theologians. Not all Lutheran, but they're, you know, just mainstream theologians.
State church
theologians. And he looks at their response to the rising tide of like a real, not just a scientific naturalism, but a philosophical naturalism wedded to a scientific naturalism. And it's interesting that there's one man, Otto Zockler, I think we've mentioned him before, who's part of he calls it the Orthodox school. He's part of this group of German Lutheran theologians, many of which left Germany for the United States and formed groups like the Missouri Synod and so on. Who actually said, we're going to stay and we're going to respond to this stuff. And Zockler, he's been lost in history.
Nobody's it's untranslated.
Yeah.
History of apologetics is still only auf Deutsch.
He's the first and the longest standing and perhaps the only real respondent to Darwin from any sort of Orthodox Christian perspective. And he hung with it throughout the course of his life, had correspondence with Darwin, asked him, and treated Darwin respectfully, but had serious disagreements with him. And but he's just one lone guy, and the rest are like the Bowers and the, you know, the Boltmans and the others who basically said, we're just going to accept all this stuff, and then we're going to reinterpret Christianity and its epistemology in light of all the latest trends.
Yep.
And then the trends change. Now we're in post-modernity, and now everybody's redefining things, and it just irritates me. Maybe I'm...
Sure.
Anyway,
sure.
Sorry.
Sure.
No, it's good. We are actually at the time for the break. So what we're going to do is we're going to go straight to our break. I'll talk about a book from the shop, and then we'll come back in. Adam said some stuff at the first that I want to revisit about what's reasonable and the like for Christians to know, or how far can we take this. So we'll be back. Hey there, and welcome to our break. What we're going to talk about today is something we've advertised on the show, you know, almost every time we do apologetics, and that's just because it's such a useful resource, and that's the Sensible Christianity audio lectures that are on the 1517 Legacy
Absolutely.
Website. And the special thing that you need to know is that the price is once again discounted there to half of what it usually is. So it's usually around $50, so it's just under $25 there now. That you can get that entire series, which is amazing. I mean, it's 14 hours of audio for $24.
This is the lay training in apologetics, done by a Missouri Lutheran, by the way. But this is the lay training in apologetics for every parish. If you buy one, get one for your parish, where there are CDs in the library and people can check out and play those CDs or whatever format is in your parish, so that they can be turned loose for people to listen to.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fantastic, and it's in a great shareable format. Audio, I mean, if you listen to podcasts, you already know the value of good audio. So,
yes.
So that's available at shop.1517legacy.com. We've talked about it, like I said, on almost every episode that we did in the original apologetics series, which is now easier than ever to find. If you go to the Thinking Fellows website, we now have category tabs on the homepage, so you can go look at the theological doctrine we've done, the church history that we've done, and the apologetics series that we've done. So if you're a new listener and you're like, okay, I want to get more. You guys have said you've done a whole series on this where we did things like the authority of Scripture, the claims of Christ. Mm-hmm. We did introduction to apologetics. We've done so many things. We did over 20 episodes there in apologetics. So you can go listen to that series. You can go hear more about Sensible Christianity there. We used the outline of Sensible Christianity to build that series.
Yeah, I hope that people who buy that get the outlines, like the teaching company, and get the outlines of each lecture for free. I want 1517 to do that. Not just audio, but here's a little booklet that'll trace the structure of every lecture.
So check it out, shop.1517legacy.com. Or if you go to this episode on the Thinking Fellows website, you can check out directly there with just that product in your cart. So that's a good option too. Again, if you don't remember URLs like I don't, you can click the link in the show notes. So I'll have it linked up there easily.
Good.
Easily.
What's a URL? To find.
The www. Dot.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. So returning back to epistemology, Adam, before the break, before you got into the
My
history
tirade.
Of this.
I want to throw something in. We mentioned earlier that Christianity is historical in a sense that many religions are not. And I want to unpack that a little bit. And this comes from philosophy of science. The question is falsification or falsifiability. Can the Christian claim be factually overthrown? And the answer is yes. It's right out of 1 Corinthians 15. Christianity as history can be overthrown as a religious claim factually. That sounds like it's a weakness. It isn't. It's a strength. If somebody says to me, intro to Phil Prof at college, you're a Christian? You say, yes, sir. He said, let me ask you a question. Is there any factual state of affairs which would cause you to leave your Christian faith? He expects you to say, no, I'll stay in no matter what. But if you answer yes, he'll be curious. And the answer is very simply, if you find the bones of Jesus, I'm out. It is in principle overthrowable. Then ask yourself the question, with any other religion, could it be factually overthrown? And what's almost the universal answer? No. In the case of Christianity, the answer is yes, it could be factually overthrown. So I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, see, that's the problem with what the Neo-Orthodox did, really, is they took something, took Christianity where the answer to that question is yes. Mm-hmm. It could be. You find the bones of Christ somewhere in a tomb in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we like Paul, 1 Corinthians 15:17, would say this is over, right? We're deceiving ourselves, we're deceiving others,
mm-hmm.
our faith is in vain. And they took that and said, gave the answer that all other religions give. Say, no, it can't
yep.
be overthrown because
yep.
even though we believe it happened,
yep.
it's not verifiable in that same way that other mm-hmm. historical truths are.
Yep, and one of the earliest analytic philosophy books, they had a guy there who represented Bart at the table. And they ate him for lunch, and he deserved it. It was a characterization, but the guy gave the answers that the Neo-Orthodox would give, saying, I'll believe anyway, and they ate him for lunch, and he deserved it.
Mm-hmm. Caleb, maybe we ought to do a show on the Neo-Orthodox since this show is turning
yeah,
into it.
Yeah, it is kind of turning into that, but yeah, that's not a bad idea to add down there. I mean, most of the history we've done has been positive history, so... But,
yeah, it's a wonderful position for having your cake and eating it too. You can allow all sorts of radical biblical criticism, you know, and smile, and at the same time you get into your pulpit as a pastor and preach Calvin's faith from the pulpit. It's just that the whole thing has got its feet firmly planted in midair.
Well, yeah, when you approach them, like if you don't, if you engage with them purely on doctrinal
uh-huh.
terms, at first it sounds pretty good.
Sure.
You know, a lot of the time, oh, yeah, this is sure. orthodox.
It's all worldview yeah. or ideology without any sort of moorings yep. in the yep. realm of facts.
Yep.
Is that,
yeah, and so yep. to transition then.
And it was cowardly.
Yeah, that was the cause of my tirade the first half
of the show.
It was
cowardly.
Yeah.
Christians just sort of. Playing backgammon at the gates when the Turks are banging on the gates.
Yeah.
Or the postmodernists.
Yep.
So, Adam, historian in the room, I know I keep trying to transition us out of this.
Okay.
But we probably do need to do a show on, since this is coming up so much. But, so then what is reasonable, factually, for Christians to be able to present or know about our faith?
Perhaps the first thing we might say is, when it comes to horizontal things, the world of facts, evidence, and so on, there is no certainty.
Yeah,
yeah, no 100% certainty.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, even geometry. You know, there's
sometimes not even trustworthiness, let alone certainty.
Right, right. But even like the most certain thing, geometry. You know, I mm-hmm. love geometry. You know,
yeah, me too. I couldn't see how you got
give me one angle and yep. you can give me the rest.
Yep.
Certainty. Even that, Morris, the something uncertainty of mathematics or something. But with non-Euclidean geometry, that's not even certain.
Yeah, Dr.
Anymore.
Robert Meyer used to do that at Concordia.
The mathematics, the loss of uncertainty is the title of the book. Well, so in history, it is not mathematics.
Nope.
It's you going back, looking at evidence, and from all these little pieces of evidence, however much you got, you draw a conclusion. And depending on how much evidence you have, how tight your inference from that evidence to that conclusion is, that's what determines how probabilistic your conclusion is. Mm-hmm. And you can have a high degree of probability, but you're never going to be 100% certain about even the claim that a week ago or a couple days ago I was hiking up towards Mount Whitney, which I failed to reach in the summit. I failed to reach the summit of which.
got it.
I'm tired. But you can't say that with absolute certainty.
Not with
even though I can tell you I was there, it was cold, and I was miserable, and so on and so forth.
Anybody in the sciences has to agree with you. The parallels philosophy of science, mm-hmm. and anyone who's familiar with it and lives in the lab will grant you that in a New York minute. Mm-hmm. That is, I'm not in the world of pure logic, and I'm not in the world of mathematics. I'm in the world of factual specificity, and I, of course, I'm limited to probability. I don't have the kind of certainty a mathematician or a logician has, and they'll grant it in a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they should.
Yeah, I mean, even right now, sitting across the table from this handsome man, Scott Keith.
I look quite tired.
He's a human, mm-hmm. but it's entirely possible. It's within the realm of possibility that he maybe isn't. Maybe he's an AI or an alien or,
you know what
or,
happens
or whatever.
When, you know what happens when somebody tries to argue that in court?
It gets thrown out.
You bet.
To be sure. But it's within, you know, it's...
And they'll censure that lawyer, too.
Yeah.
The coinage in
hope
a court...
So.
Yeah. The coinage in a courtroom is not conceptual possibility. The coinage in the courtroom is factual dependability. Yeah,
yeah. You think that's going to last?
It's got to last.
Ooh, this sort of seen this sort of it's kind of on the way out.
This sort of stuff has got to be argued, or we lose the whole West.
Well, that's the thing with like this postmodern stuff. They have all these sophisticated arguments for sort of relativism. But if they had a heart issue, would they go to a doctor who is a postmodernist?
No.
No. Yeah. Would they, if they were being sued, would they employ a lawyer who is a relativist? Absolutely
no.
not. So when it comes to real life, where the rubber hits the road. Even the hardcore relativist looks both ways when he's crossing the street.
Yeah,
sure.
Right.
But when they're talking about abstract nonsense, then they wax eloquent on relativity and so on and so forth.
When life doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That's when you can be a relativist.
When you have a bunch of students in front of you,
yeah.
you can mess up their heads.
Yep. And they're taking notes because mm-hmm. you're up in front.
Mm-hmm.
You can mess up their heads and help them piss off their parents.
Yeah.
That was when I referred to Richard Rorty. There's this book called Rorty and His Critics. It's
okay.
People criticizing him, and Rorty responds, and where he says he's accused of being a propagandist, much like the Nazi propagandist in 1930s Germany. His response was, I'm exactly like them. I take delight. I consider it, consider myself this great gift to these students when I expose the arrogance and bias and chauvinism of their parents and their religious worldviews, and I take delight in deconstructing all that. And he comes to the conclusion and says something like, you ask me how I differ from the Nazi propagandists. I don't really differ except I serve a nobler cause.
What's the nobler cause?
How do you know that?
Neo-pragmatism.
How do you know that?
God.
That's my secularism.
That's my problem.
Americans.
I don't want to, if we need to. But that's my problem with all the stuff that's going on in the culture right now. When I'm going to shut up.
Well, there's this social justice ethic, right?
Our culture, with probably like Adam said, while we were sitting playing backgammon, right, have taken society down this road where mm-hmm. nothing is objective, especially nothing having to do with morality is objective, are coming in through the back door and making every moral assertion that they want to make objective.
Yep.
You can't do that anymore. If you've participated in the destruction of moral objectivity, you can no longer make moral objective claims.
Or anybody has a right to ask you, where's it grounded?
Or we have the right to ask you where it's grounded. Now, see, the difference is I can answer that question.
Yep.
I can answer that question.
Yep.
When I say that it's wrong to cheat on your wife, when the children ought to honor their parents and not, you know, participate in Rorty's attempts to continually help you piss them off, I can ground that objectively. Especially, I can get back all the way to the trustworthiness of the documents and the objective claims made in those and why they can be trusted in the whole nine yards. What can you do?
Yeah,
I mean, and I don't want to do this too much because this gets into, like Adam said, worldview stuff, and it gets a little weird.
Yeah.
But it is frustrating.
Yeah.
I mean, it is frustrating to watch the destruction of objective belief.
Yes.
And then have these same people bring it in the back door with their own causes.
Yep.
It can really.
They have the power.
Make a tired person wake up.
Every parent that says, I don't know that I want to pay thousands for my child to be schooled in that, is right to worry.
You bet they're right.
They're correct to worry.
You bet they're right.
Well, this turned into a different sort of episode. I mean, that's not a bad thing, though. I mean,
No, it really is an epistemology.
Yeah. No, the point of the show, like we've always said, is to introduce people to these meaningful conversations. And so when I bring up a question like epistemology and it goes down this road, I mean, the idea is this is kind of where the thought and the problems are.
Sure.
In today's world. And so
particularly the universities.
Yeah. And the hope that we have is rooted in Christ, right? In that,
sure.
In the verifiability of that and the falsifiability of those claims.
Yep.
And
almost no other religion can compete at that level.
And the main point, I guess, of this episode is to say, don't give that position up so easily. Don't,
yes.
Don't do what the neo-Orthodox have
right.
done or what the
Or the James K.A. Smith, Who's Afraid of Postmodernism.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Or even like, really hardcore fideists, right? Or
right.
You have to be in already. Don't give up that point because that's kind of what we have left. That's what makes us unique, Christianity unique. And it's what makes it so that, the claims of atheists out there or, hardcore, Darwinist scientists and things like that don't have just an immediate leg up over us where they can say, you have this blind faith that's not rooted in anything and we have facts, and so there's good reason to believe that the world is meaningless,
Yeah.
We have a position that we ought not give up so easily.
Yep. Couldn't agree more.
So
that was a good bookend on a not very eloquent rant on my part. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
How about my grammar about Whitney? I've had 2 hours of sleep.
So if you are having a hard time keeping up with this episode, because one of the things I realized sitting here is that there's a lot of names that people probably might not recognize, especially when we talked about the neo-Orthodox and stuff. And I think I'll make plans so that we can go in and clarify about that in an episode regarding neo-Orthodoxy. But
I'll bet you Rod has an outline here or there on some of these names.
Sure.
He does.
Bart and Boltman.
Sure.
Those are probably the two big ones that they mm-hmm. should take a look at.
There are some other things you can go
Tillich,
listen
maybe.
Listen to from us that will help get to the point of this. So we also did an introduction episode to what is apologetics back during the apologetics series that I will link to this that would be a helpful resource after listening to this episode. So we brought up this position that we hold on to and that we ought not give up and kind of the reasons it's been given up and who it's been given up by
sure.
in history. But we have episodes where we have done the verified the falsifiability of the claims of Christ, mm-hmm. the reliability of the New Testament documents and stuff like that. And that's all available for free on the Thinking Fellows website. Or if you subscribe to the show via a podcasting app, you can go look at that.
And the time will come when many of these books will be available in outline format done by my students. And they'll be, I hope, on the cheap. Not some sort of thing you have to wonder about whether you want to lay your Visa card down or your MasterCard. But, I hope less than even $2 where you can look at an outline of a whole book, a major one, and see it in 10 pages or so, the structure and the argument of the book. My students did that at 3 institutions for 30 years. And those I want to get out, and it's going to be through 1517
yeah.
that I want to make them available to people and just take them and go.
Yeah, that's a major project and goal for 1517. So, you can guarantee that when that finally does become all available online, that the Thinking Fellows will let you know, that we will announce that on the show and alike, and we'll have links to where that'll all be available, whether some of them for free on the website or parts in groups on the shop and things like that. We'll make sure that that's all available to people. I hope this episode was helpful in getting people to engage this question mm-hmm. of how do I know what I know, and that Christians ought not be afraid to ask that question.
Yep.
And so thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the show. We've gained, at the beginning of the new year, we gained so many new donors. It's really been incredible. You guys keep the show coming weekly, and we're just really thankful for the ability to come back and do this week after week. Like I said, this is probably the capstone episode for January. So if you follow us into February, we're going to mix it up again like we did last month. So we'll bring in some different doctrines. We'll talk about some a great thinker in the Christian faith. We'll talk about apologetics some more. And maybe even do this episode on neo-orthodoxy. So thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.